Hello, and welcome to another episode of Temporal Culture War, where we dig into what the hell was going on in America in the early 2000s while we watch one of television history's most maligned properties, which is, of course, Star Trek, Enterprise. I'm Maddie Lipchansky.
I'm Clayton Ashley, and I realized something. We've been adding the semicolon Enterprise this whole time, even though we established that's not the case for two seasons.
It's not the title of the episode. Not the title of the show. It's just Enterprise, right?
Yeah, for no good reason.
I know the reason. It's because they're trying to get Lawrence, Kansas to tune in.
And they really did with this episode, but we'll get to that.
Oh, yeah. Anyways, this week it is episode 17 of season 1, Fusion. And the week of February 27th, 2002... Also, most of February 2002, because there was in real time, cast your mind back to February of 2002. Mm-hmm. It is February 13th, and you're like, time to buckle up for another episode of my favorite show, Enterprise, which I don't know if it is or is not Star Trek because it's not in the title. However, it is the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, Utah. So we are catapulting our friend Mitt Romney to fame instead of... Star Trek Enterprise episodes. So there's 2 weeks of reruns, and now back on February 27th, we are back in the game.
So 2 points. One, we did this intentionally. We took a break because that was real time representing the fact that the Winter Olympics were going on. We never breaks on this show. We never miss a scheduled release. It's just intentional.
That's right.
Point two, what reruns were they? Do we know?
So the week previous... On the 20th.
What would they choose?
Yeah. It was a repeat of Breaking the Ice.
Oh, that's too bad.
And a repeat of Fortunate Son.
Just repeat the two Schran episodes. Come on.
And the week before that was a rerun of... the week before that was not reruns. I'm sorry. They just put Shuttle Pod 1 up against the Olympics. I'm sorry. It was just a one-week break. So everyone's having to watch... Breaking the Ice, which was that was the one where they're stuck in the ice planet, right?
Yeah, kind of a little repeat of Shuttle Pod 1.
Yeah,
like them being stuck in a shuttle pod. Here's more of that shit.
Yeah, and then Fortunate Son was the one with
football. I took a note of that because we got another football reference.
That's right. So this week, this month, this like 2 week stretch in the world, I will say. Not an incredible time to be alive. Two big things happened that I want to talk about. First was, I don't know if you or many of our listeners are familiar with the Gujarat riots in 2002 in India.
I can't say I am.
Yeah, so it's kind of a long story, but there was... So the chief minister of Gujarat at the time was Modi, Narendra Modi, who's now the prime minister of India. And so he is an important figure, and he was basically, he was cleared of wrongdoing, so big allegedly alert. Mm-hmm. Allegedly was condoning and stoking a big anti-Muslim riot that lasted 3 days and about 1,000 people died. This was mostly related to the temple that they wanted to build at the site in Ayodhya, which is where they have it's an important site in the, I believe, the Ramayana. It's where Ram was supposedly born. And at the time, there was a mosque there that was burned down in a different riot in 1992. The BJP, of course, a Hindu nationalist party today, built a big temple on the site there. But some pilgrims coming back from Ayodhya were attacked by a mob of Hindu nationalists. Modi was not the mastermind behind a riot. You can't really say that, but was sort of like loosely approving of it. And that's where he really made a name for himself. And this was like a big step forward in the Hindu nationalist movement. So that's going on. Basically, while the Star Trek episode is on.
I don't think I was aware of the particulars, but I did know there was some bad news in Modi's past.
Yes.
So connecting the dots here.
This is like the big one that he was fairly responsible for. It's, you know, just an interesting sort of data point in the like we are sowing the seeds of the middle 21st century around this time. The other big thing, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, Modi. And also, I don't know if you've heard of this guy, but it says he was the president of the United States of America, which I'm seeing was a country that existed from the 1700s until about the year 2120.
That long ago, really?
Yeah. So, but this guy, George W. Bush, was the president of it, America. And so according to a book by an author named Rowan Scarborough called Rumsfeld's War, on February 16th, 2002, George W. Bush secretly signed a National Security Council directive establishing the goals and objectives to invade Iraq a year before it was really public.
Wow.
So I'm reading from a Guardian article here in 2004, which is from the week that that book came out.
Mm-hmm.
So the revelation cast doubt on the public insistence by the U.S. and British officials throughout 2002 that no decision had been taken to go to war pending negotiations at the United Nations. This guy Scarborough was the Pentagon correspondent for the Washington Times, which is a conservative rag, but whatever. So he signed this this secret letter. excuse me. So, you know, the National Security Council refused to comment on the book's claims about the February directive. Quote, "I don't do book reviews," a White House official said. So, you know, this was like the beginning of the Iraq War, a full year before the public ramp up to it. Stuff that you hear and you're like, oh, of course, because everything since then has been basically corroborated that these people were trying to do it. But
it's so weird how we live in an era, a time of so many conspiracy theories and wild accusations of what's going on in government. And here they just wrote it down. They just wrote down. It's like, this is what we were going to do. We're lying about it. And it doesn't matter.
Yeah. They're taking notes on a criminal conspiracy. Yeah. I mean, these people were not smart. It's also like, it's a very funny thing where, like everyone is a conspiracy theorist now. And a lot of them are wrong, but then stating the plain truth makes you sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
So, anyways, total information collapse. The world is ending. what else happened?
What else happened?
So, I mean, I think it's just sort of like we are seeing, like, I believe the era that we wanted to cover in the show is finally starting to happen. International 2000s fascism is happening.
Yeah, we were in. I honestly thought a little bit longer of a, like, the hangover of the 90s.
Yeah.
Staying there a bit, but, like, this is where it's the dark turn starts to really happen.
The long 90s are finally over. exemplified no more than, of course, The Callings, Wherever You Go, hitting number 7 on the Billboard charts.
This is just waiting. What is it going to be? What new metal?
It's at number 7. Number 1, Ja Rule featuring Ashanti, Always on Time. That's fine.
That's fine.
How You Remind Me, Holding Strong at number 2 by Nickelback.
Too bad.
Yeah, Pink's Get the Party Started has reached its, is at number 9, still hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
Who else is here? Puddle of Mud's Blurry is in at number 17. I will say one good song, Outkast featuring Killer Mike's The Whole World, which you recall from the soundtrack of the film Idlewild, is at number 19. Pretty good song. At number 26, 5 for Fighting's Superman, which is not to be confused with $3 Down Kryptonite.
Yeah. When does that Superman movie come out? It's like 2004 or something.
Like, yeah, something like that.
Sent on the Patreon. I'm sorry, I can't remember who specifically sent this, but it was interesting. It talked about why it was actually unusual how stable the charts were in 2002. Like, this was a thing where there was not much turnover, especially compared to, like, I guess these days. So that's something I don't know if it was.
I wonder if it's because a lot of albums were delayed.
That's a good thought. Yeah.
I think it's probably like looking at box office numbers in like early COVID lockdown, where it's just sort of like nothing's coming out. We're just going to keep having the, you know, Ooh, I found something portentous all the way down at number 59, which is POD's Youth of the Nation.
Now, no, wait a minute. This is one of those ones where it's like, I think I know what this one sounds like, but I have to remind myself.
We are the youth of the nation.
Fucking hell.
Oh, I forgot I could search for new songs here. So new this week, new singles. Michelle Branch is All You Wanted at number 67. Enrique Iglesias' Escape at 70.
Going to YouTube to just remind myself about Youth of the Nation. They're touring.
POD is?
Yeah, Michigan, Milwaukee. Okay.
That's awesome. Hey, here's a question for you,
yeah,
Clayton. What do you think POD stands for?
Piece of Damnation.
Payable on Death.
Sure.
Which is a hard name for a Christian metal band.
Okay, I'm going to admit something. Forgot the Christian part.
Yeah, they are Christian. The band's lineup, of course, consists of vocalist Paul Joshua, quote, Sonny Sandoval, bassist Mark Tra Daniels, and of course, drummer Noah Wov Bernardo.
I wouldn't be surprised if they're bigger than ever because of that.
Yeah.
I know that Christian rock has only gotten, like, bigger as it's become its own self-perpetuating industry.
Yeah, I mean, they started as a thrash metal three-piece with no vocals called Eschatos.
Wow.
Which is pretty good. Anyways.
So much more than I expected to think about POD this
well,
fine day.
Well, you should have known because you're on the show Temporal Culture War. Let's keep it moving along to the television ratings. So this week, February 27th, Wednesday, 2002, Star Trek Enterprise. Now they've started to air Enterprise and then a rerun of Enterprise afterwards.
Oh, good. To catch people up.
So after this episode is a rerun of Cold Front.
Wait, but that's not the ice one. Okay, yeah.
Cold Front is... I can't even keep the episode straight anymore.
It's the one that features our Galaxy Quest... what's his name? Who's related to the... Daniels!
That's our Galaxy Quest Daniels. That's right. That's the one where they're like trying to look at the Great Plume.
Yes. Yes.
And there's the weird people on the ship. There's a Silic. That's a Silic episode.
That's a Silic.
Thumbs down. Anyways, Star Trek Enterprise has a 5 share. It's getting his ass completely demolished by the Grammys. Where I believe this is an Alicia Keys kind of year where she's dominating. It is also getting its ass kicked by, again, My Wife and Kids and According to Jim.
Got my ass kicked by My Wife and Kids.
Yeah. Star Trek Enterprise rerun is getting its ass kicked by The Drew Carey Show. It's a dog eat Drew world.
Wow.
What season of The Drew Carey Show is that? Is what I gotta know. What season do you think? It's season 7 of The Drew Carey Show, still chugging along on CBS. ABC, sorry. CBS is the Grammys. And then also both those things getting its ass demolished by, yeah, the Grammys. And of course, a rerun of the 1998 film Rush Hour.
Why not?
beating both Star Treks pretty handily. Star Treks, however, are beating on the WB. a running program I don't remember where they would show movies on the WB, but it was called Flicks from the Frog, but they were playing Dumb and Dumber.
Well, I mean, they got something. I thought you were going to say that they were continuing to defeat their nemesis. Gilmore Girls? What was it?
Last time it was
there was some WB thing they managed.
I actually can't remember who they beat last time. It was Dawson's Creek, I believe.
Dawson's Creek. That's
they took down, yeah. But they, yeah. Anyways, so that's the television, and I'll take you, of course, to the movies. So we have 2 weeks of the movies to cover.
Oh.
Because we were away for 2 weeks. So new last week, which is the week of February 15 to 21. New is John Q, a movie I've never seen. That's the one where Denzel Washington is a guy named John Q.
Oh, wait, this is the hospital one, right?
It's the hospital one.
Wait, takes a hospital hostage. I saw
they won't give his son a heart transplant, and he takes the hospital hostage. I've actually never seen John Q.
It sounds so relevant.
Yeah. That movie, however, that comes in at number one. Also new last week, at number two, was a movie I have seen, which is, of course, Britney Spears' Crossroads.
Oh,
a great film. A great film.
I want to see the co-stars in that because I've forgotten that existed.
Yeah.
No, not the 1986 film. The 2002 film, please. That's right. Zoe Saldana?
Yeah.
What?
It's got a crazy cast. It rips.
Dan
it's so good.
Justin Long. I mean, okay, it's the 90s. It's the aughts, I mean.
Yeah.
He's got to be in there. All right.
Also new this week, is a film I did not know existed, but came in at number three, and a movie that ends up making $115 million worldwide, Return to Neverland, which is an animated Peter Pan sequel that I've never heard of, that is based on a J.M. Barrie book called When Wendy Grew Up. An incredible thing is, if you look up this movie, the main poster for it is just like the silhouette of Peter Pan, and it says Peter Pan in Return to Neverland, which feels like that's where the actor goes.
Right.
So they're sort of positing that the actor you love, Peter Pan, is returned to play himself in this new animated film. This movie exists. I don't remember it at all.
It's an hour and 12 minutes.
It takes place during World War II.
Whoa.
Wendy's daughter Jane is kidnapped by Captain Hook, and Peter Pan must come to the rescue.
I know they made a ton of these like sequels, but they were usually direct-to-video. So interesting.
This feels like a direct-to-video-ass kind of movie. You know, I wonder if it was going to be direct-to-video, and then they're like, well, 9/11 happened.
Let's give one for the kids.
It was designed as a theatrical release. It started as a video release in Canada, and then they switched it to the main jam.
There we go.
It's a real Disney's Planes situation. So hanging around last week at number four, Big Fat Liar, Collateral Damage, Beautiful Mind. At number seven, a new movie called Heart's War, which is a Bruce Willis joint that the poster strikes a real impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
It's Bruce Willis, Colin Farrell, Terrence Howard. It's fucking directed by Gregory Hoblit, who directed the film Frequency, which I have seen. And Primal Fear. Okay, sure. Whatever. This feels like a movie that would have been, like, if you watched it today, you're probably like, this rocks and it's the best movie ever made, because that's how things are now.
Yeah.
At number eight, a little film called Super Troopers. Clayton.
Oh.
Did you watch, were you a child of The Broken Lizard?
I'm ashamed to say no. I have not.
Don't be ashamed. I mean, they never made anything good again. I guess J. Chandrasekhar did direct a bunch of Arrested Developments, if I recall.
Okay. This isn't related to the Blarth movies, right?
You mean Paul Blart?
Yeah, Blart.
Have you added an H to... Sorry, Paul Blarth?
Paul Blarth.
Was Paul Blarth there?
Was Paul Blarth there?
All right, so Super Troopers is not important to you, that's fine. That was a movie I watched in college, maybe weekly, to my mental detriment. All right, so the week of this actual episode, a couple new movies. Coming in at number one, Anne Rice's Queen of the Damned.
Oh.
Which you may remember as the Aaliyah Lestat movie. That's the one where Lestat becomes a rock star and it wakes up Aaliyah.
Right. Oh my God. This was definitely one of those things where I saw that poster and was like, I'll never be allowed to see that movie. It's rated R.
Yeah. I mean, the poster is sexy, but it's also like they replaced fucking Tom Cruise with Stuart Townsend, you know? So it's sort of like, wait, Tom Cruise? Yeah, he was Lestat, right? Am I crazy?
I'm checking.
He was Lestat.
Oh, right. I forgot that Aaliyah died in 2001.
Yeah, she died in the plane crash. Famous.
Oh, okay. So it was dedicated to her.
Oh, yeah. She died between the filming and the release. I love the Interview with the Vampire books and movies and TV shows so much because it is Anne Rice. Basing a guy, Lestat is based on her husband.
I've heard this story. It's
and
so
she's
good.
Just like, what if my husband, who's like the hottest, coolest guy who's ever lived, who's so charismatic, what if every boy in the world wanted to make out with him? And that's the whole series. Anne Rice, I know you're listening in heaven. You are a queen to me. I saw a photo when I was in New Orleans last year. I went to a bookstore to sign some stock when I was there, and it was like the bookstore that Anne Rice did all of her events at.
Oh my God.
When she was alive. And one of her books for her birthday, she had a jazz funeral down the street where she rode around in a coffin. And I love her so much.
Did she also have a jazz funeral when she really had a funeral?
I actually don't know.
It's cool either way.
It's cool either way. Yeah. Also new this week is at number three, Dragonfly. Which, do you know the film Dragonfly?
I know the TV show. I don't know the...
Are you thinking of Firefly?
I am.
A grieving doctor is being contacted by his deceased wife through her patient's near-death experiences.
Oh, that's X-Files.
It's a Kevin Costner movie.
I mean, I kind of like a Costner.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's directed by Tom Shadyac.
Who did Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Directed the Ace Ventura films, The New Professor, Liar Liar, Patch Adams, and Bruce Almighty.
I mean, Liar Liar's pretty good.
Liar Liar's pretty good. Here comes the claw. So that's at number three. Number two, John Q, Hanging Tough. At number 43 is the film Monsoon Wedding by Mira Nair, a movie I love dearly, and you should... Oh, no. Yes. Yes.
You do love it or not?
I do. I almost started talking about a different Mira Nair movie. Monsoon Wedding rocks. If you've ever seen the film Rachel Getting Married,
okay,
it is kind of loosely based on Monsoon Wedding. Two movies I love a lot. They have the same cinematographer. They look very similar. Monsoon Wedding rips. It is directed by Mira Nair, who, of course, is the mother of future New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, my friend and yours.
Beautiful. I'd love to see it.
Yeah. Mira Nair, great. You should watch that. And Mississippi Masala, stat, if you've never seen them.
It is such a nice thing whenever I've seen somebody on social media be like, wait, that's his mom?
Yeah, and I'm like, some of us have known this for like 7 years.
When he was our representative in the state legislature.
We've known him a long time. We're old pals. Anyways, also, lastly new this week, and then we'll move on to the episode, at number 57... a film called How to Kill Your Neighbor's Dog. A sarcastic playwright in Los Angeles gets new neighbors, a single mom and 8-year-old girl. His wife wants kids and babysits the girl. He doesn't want kids, yet plays with her to find out how children talk for his play. Paternal instincts? I just wanted to read the official Box Office Mojo fucking description of this film. Listen, Clayton, this movie
made
$49,894. Well, if you look at Box Office Mojo, if it's new, it's bolded.
Now, is this based on the life story of Christy Noem? Hi-yo!
Hey-o! Watch out!
Watch out.
So that's I've been your science officer for the day.
You were relieved of duty.
I'm saluting.
You've done a great job this week.
Yeah, that was a lot to cover this week. Yeah,
it was.
I'm going to head to the mess hall and try some of this chicken I've been hearing so much about.
Oh, yeah.
This human food.
Can't wait. This episode, which is uncomfortable sometimes, but also okay, it's interesting.
It's a weird one,
yeah.
Kids.
So let's get started on this, the 17th episode of Enterprise. So this episode is called Fusion. It was originally titled Equilibrium, and then they're like, oh wait, that's the title of a Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode. So
it's also the title of a film that came out in December 2002.
So that was Equilibrium was just in the substrate. I don't know.
Hey, real quick, I guess we'll get to it because I bet Star Trek will be. We'll get to a whole discussion of the film Equilibrium when we get to December of this year. But I'm so excited to talk about Gunkata for 45 minutes on the podcast.
One of the movies that represents 2002 in an actually good way. Can't wait.
Does it?
I mean, in the like, you can enjoy how the astonishing culture that was produced.
Yeah, that's true. It's sort of like, what if we hit the Matrix in the head really big with a hammer, really, really hard, and we put a child in a backpack? Anyways.
So the beginning of Fusion... is Archer being like, hey, this child's book I read as a child had a nebula on it, and now we're going to go visit that nebula. And T'Pol is...
What books are you reading, dude?
Yeah. T'Pol is bored? Charmed? I don't know. She's just blank in this, like, first scene, and I guess it's just to establish things, but, like, this is a nothing burger, and it's just because we brought it up again with the, like, Cold Front episode where they're gonna go see the gas or whatever. They do this a lot, it feels like. When they need a B-plot, it's like, oh, they're going to go look at a gas giant and scan
they're charting it. Leave me alone.
It's the most boring-ass shit, but it's got to be the background. So it's like, you guys could be, like, investigating a black hole sucking in a star. Something, like, sick. But
no,
we're just going to chart a nebula he saw as a kid.
Yeah, we got to chart it. We're going to scan it, and we're going to chart it. Which, scanning it, by the way, takes 75 hours to do.
Yeah. Charting takes a lot longer, though.
That's right.
So we get our beautiful intro song leading us to the real meat of this episode, which is that they run into some Vulcans, some country bumpkins. these are, it's such an interesting thing that these Vulcans, they quickly discover, are both like the hippie version of Vulcans, but what that means is that they're Republicans. It's kind of interesting. You find this out just both by how the main dude talks. He's just almost got a little bit of that, like, as much as a Vulcan can be country, he's just got a little bit of that in the way he talks.
He's got some fucking, he's like very Kurt Russell-y.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, interestingly, Robert Pine, yes, the father of Chris Pine.
No shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, little weird connection there to a future Star Trek captain. And yeah, he's finding it. He just kind of disappears through half the episode. But anyway, and then they invite him to dinner. And to, again, establish how weird these Vulcans are, he asks for chicken. And he knows it's meat. And he still wants to eat it.
Yeah.
T'Pol is disgusted. and
sorry,
calls,
the way that you said it. You just looked right at the camera. You're like, T'Pol was disgusted.
She's not taking this. I mean, you know, in her like restrained way.
It looked, she acts as if she had just seen Paul Blarth fart.
In Super Troopers, right?
Yeah. Paul Blarth himself.
She then says that they're Vosh Katur. I think I have that.
Yeah, please pronounce it correctly.
Yeah.
Please.
Vulcans without logic. And at this point, I decided for some reason to go look at who directed this episode. I forgot their name, but interestingly, the only episode they ever directed, their greatest work aside from this is Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. Just keep that in mind.
The first Jason I ever saw. That movie, anyway. Oh man, that movie kicks ass.
That's what's funny is I looked into it and it's like people are divisive about this one where they think it's terrible for the franchise or the best one. And I'm like,
it's so funny.
I guess I got to check this out.
It is, I believe, intentionally a funny movie.
I see. It sounds hilarious. Just the name of it, Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. Beautiful.
Yeah. It's incredible.
Rolls off the tongue. So they tell this crew of Vulcans who their ship is old and shitty. They could use some help repairing it. They're not really on good terms with the rest of the Vulcans, so that's why they'd appreciate the help. And so some of their crew comes along and they start interacting with members of the Enterprise crew. So that's going to be like the basis of the show. There's not a lot of techie sci-fi in this episode. This is about cultural sci-fi and learning more about Vulcans. So for instance, we get this guy who's kind of an engineer and he starts hanging out with Trip. I like him. I think he's good. He's asking Trip about how decadent humans are, and he has all these exaggerated rumors about how they sleep half the day, how they eat six times a day.
I love this guy so much. I guess we'll get to it, but like I just love, A, as a big girl, I love seeing a chubby Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me very happy to see a chubby Vulcan out there. Finally, a chubby Vulcan, which I don't think we've gotten before or since.
Yeah, I guess not.
I love his, so he just sort of like, he's not acting at all. He's just sort of like he's not acting Vulcan-y. He's just sort of like, hey, you want to talk about what sex is like? Hey, man, come sit down. We're talking about what it's like to fuck. You want to hang out and talk about fucking? He rocks all this guy. He's like the fail son of the senator.
That's literally what I wrote. Oh, he's a fail son.
He's
even
a fail
better.
Son. I really, truly, this is like the first non-Shran character that since like Phlox that I've been like, I need this guy more.
Adding him to the list of Blorbos.
A third Blorbo has struck the show. And he never comes back, of course.
So we'll come back to them. Because then we get a talk where the Vulcans are not in the room with Archer and T'Pol. And they're basically going on with their debate of what this episode is about. Which is that Archer likes them because they're Republicans. T'Pol is like, reintegrating Vulcan emotions always fails. Because that's their point, is that they don't try to repress their emotions. They think it's important to kind of acknowledge and integrate them, which is funny because that's like good. We're going to see how like this episode kind of makes their perspective icky in some ways. And yet their whole point about like, you can't just deny your emotions. You need to acknowledge and have some control over them so they don't control you. And it's like, that seems pretty like mature and normal. But I guess we're trying to make a point about how these Vulcans in this era are actually kind of stunted in some ways they won't admit.
Yeah, but I think this is like a legitimately interesting thing where like they took like the Vulcans who we know what they're like from mm-hmm. many, 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 many Star Trek shows. But also like changes something about their past, right? Like the fact that like we meet the Vulcans in the original series and then in a lot of other shows, and the Vulcans are very like, sure, obviously they're obsessed with logic, but there is also this weird mysticism to them that kind of doesn't square exactly.
Right.
And the show here is like, well, when you meet the Vulcans on this show, they are just logical. The mysticism is not there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, and it's just sort of like, how do they square? And it's like, oh, you start watching the show, like have they mischaracterized the Vulcans that you see?
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, no, it's actually, we're going to try and do something interesting, like with the prequel storytelling here, best we can.
Yeah.
Which is like, how does a race arrive at this weird, like, or how does a culture rather arrive at this very strange set of beliefs? And it's like, well, Vulcans like feel emotions more than usual people, so they actually do have to be controlling them.
Yeah.
But like, that makes you a maniac.
Yeah, I'm not
to control it completely, right?
I'm not fully on board with some of the things they do, but I do appreciate that they're taking the stance that their culture is not static. It changes over time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not in ice. And so, and that gives us a chance for drama like this episode, even if it kind of fails in some instances. But
yeah, this episode kind of feels like a one-act play where nothing happens.
Yeah. So yeah, they have this debate. Obviously, you see what sides they're on. But will that stay their sides? We'll see.
I bet they will.
Yeah. We get kind of the big introduction of Enrique Murciano as Tolaris. And he's kind of the like, God, is he a fuckboy Vulcan?
He's certainly the horniest Vulcan.
Because I feel like that might be a bridge too far. But like, they're definitely by just, I think, and first of all, by casting him as a guy who stars in rom-coms, Enrique Murciano, it feels like they're like trying to present him as he's hot. But that haircut is doing him no favors.
That man is not hot. He does not look hot. Yeah, he is sort of like, he feels like a little bit of a fuckboy. He's kind of like the Dr. Bashir of Vulcans.
Maybe that's what they're trying. It just doesn't fully work, at least early on, honestly. Like,
this guy doesn't have the fucking charisma to pull off the writing.
I think
this is an acting issue.
This early on, I mean, they're just trying to imply that, like, in addition to trying to get to pull to, like, break out of her shell and try some of your hippy-dippy, what are they called again?
Emotions.
Vash couture. That they're not without logic. They just they integrate or whatever. But the scene that they're in alone is in the mess hall, and he's like, I want to try human food. Can you help me? And she's like, how about mint tea? And he tries it and he's like, this is so flavorful. And yet you drink it when you could drink Vulcan tea. Interesting. And he's also standing extremely close to her during the scene to make it more horny, I guess, but it's mostly just like, this is this seeding what will become the main plot or the main crux of the episode later. Also, she reveals that she has gained a sense of humor at this point. It's very dry, but I like it about her. I like that she doesn't take shit in the form of this guy's little manipulations. But I don't know if it's here or in another scene, but they also debate Surak,
who
is a Vulcan.
He is the most important Vulcan to ever live. He's like the Vulcan Descartes, who's also Jesus.
And he came up in that like that big Vulcan episode in the original series, right? Where they have Ponfar. Is it that where we like kind of learn a lot about him?
And he's like the father of like Vulcan philosophy. He's the guy that was like, hey, we should calm down as a species.
Yeah.
We should become the most repressed motherfuckers in the universe.
That's just a misinterpretation. And that's interesting here. We get that these people aren't just like, we hate Surak and his religion. They're just like, no. Everybody misinterpreted what he say. It wasn't about repressing our emotions. It was about integrating them. Their whole perspective of like, you got to figure out a way to live with them.
And I mean, I think that's basically where things end up, right? Like,
exactly. Yeah.
Culturally. And they're, yeah, it's like, oh, like we, the doctrine has been misread. We're Lutherans.
Yeah. okay. And then we get, oh, okay. They're at Archer's childhood nebula. Hooray. I think this is the one scene that the security officer and a couple other bridge members are in, but they were probably there to shoot like 5 episodes that day. So like, why not?
Yeah.
And the hippie Vulcan, what is this? Taurus something? Whatever. Chris Pine's dad.
So his name is like, Ford Taurus, I believe.
We can help out with our super scanners, and this will all go very fast.
Yeah.
But he wants to pull to go over to their ship and help out on that.
Yeah.
We get another scene with Enrique. Tolaris.
His name is Enrique.
Arguing about the Vulcan texts again, but this time he's like, hey, just try it. You're a scientist. Don't meditate, and you'll dream, and you'll get some good dreams. Trust me. I'm a sexy, apparently. Mm-hmm. Because that's also part of what's going on here, is as much she is pushing away and is against this whole idea, she's definitely intrigued. Like, that's the point.
Yeah.
And so the next, we're back with Trip and our favorite fail son, who is definitely showing his, like, I'm European. What is football? American is football.
Yeah.
Is it a blood sport? That's what I assume. Which is great, because this marks the second time we've had football specifically on this show. Get baseball out of here. That's
Get
Deep Space
water
Nine.
Polo out of here.
Isn't water polo Archer's thing, though? That's what I was
It is Archer's
remember.
Thing, but they kind of have stopped bringing it up.
It's like, yeah. I was like,
it's in like the first episode or two, and he's just fucking dropped it since.
It's like, I guess he went to Stanford and that's big there or something. I don't know. It's
fucking,
like,
who cares? I just love so much that water polo as a sport survived World War III.
Yeah.
That's one of the first things to come back.
Exactly. It's safe. The water protects you from the radiation.
That's actually a really good point.
So then we also, this is that scene you were alluding to where he starts talking about sex. As Trip is trying to like very casually ask him about it. And he's like, oh, you mean sex?
Oh, you mean when we are as having sex with each other.
And everybody in the mess hall like turns silent and looks at them.
Yeah. It's
kind of funny. I guess we also have Malcolm in this scene too, because he's like, hey, what are y'all talking about? And he's like, we're talking about sex. Want to join us?
Yeah.
Or
something I have every 7 years for some reason.
Yeah, mating rituals. This is apparently canonically the first. Somebody pointed out in like some critics from the era was like, this probably marks the first time any humans learned about Vulcan mating rituals because they're so circumspect about it. And this guy's not. And apparently this is all the first time humans have met these like outcast Vulcans who are willing to talk about it. So conceivably, these are the first two to learn about Ponthar. Even though
they told nobody about it.
I guess not. Just using it.
Because then later when Spock brings it up, everyone's like, what?
What?
I also love so much that these outcast Vulcans are not like living on a colony somewhere, but just like tooting around space.
It's
very strange to me. It's like I'm a religious pilgrim. I'm gonna get on a ship and sail around in a circle.
It's very much they're doing the commune thing. Like, this is a hippie commune.
It is, but shouldn't they go find a planet?
Yeah. Safer, definitely.
Cheaper episode to film. Just get some rooms.
We had to see what it looked like on a Vulcan spaceship. This was also the first time we got to see what that looked like. But it's also an old one, and I guess it's kind of more like a Winnebago, so.
It does kind of look like a Winnebago in there, which again tracks with the commune angle.
This is where we find Admiral Forrest's calling. And I was like, oh shit, are the Vulcans mad? They're talking to these outcasts. No, it's just that literally one of the high command is like, my hippie son is on that ship. Can you please tell him to come home? I'm dying.
I'm dying from Vulcan's disease.
So that was an interesting dramatic valence that I completely forgot about, but did make me enjoy the fail son even more.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, it's time for Jazz Dream.
Oh my God.
What the hell?
I kind of loved this.
It's so bizarre. So we
so get, bizarre.
We get to Pol not meditating and choosing to go with those interesting dreams, which for her is to be in like old New York. I'm not sure exactly
No,
what era.
She's in San Francisco in a human disguise.
That's it.
Because right, she is remembering what happened to her, but she is wishing that she were a human, is my understanding of this.
and could enjoy the like strange horny acid jazz that humans enjoy. It's I like jazz. I like a lot of jazz. This is not the kind of jazz I typically go for, but it works for her. She's delighted by it.
I wish it was acid jazz. Can you imagine she goes in there and it's fucking Jamiroquai?
Oh my God. Yeah, you're right. This is more horny noodling. I don't know.
It is sort of like, I would say, horny noodling.
I want to clearly be here. I'm not actually talking about horny in terms of like sex. I'm turning like, there's just lots of horns. Just like.
It is kind of like, but it is like a horny. It looks like it both looks and sounds like someone trying, like someone hearing about an Andy Warhol film and being like, yeah, this is what happens, right? It's just like. And a girl like rolling around in bed being like,
yeah. So she's simultaneously like in the cafe sitting there in her like disguise hood that protects her ears from being seen so she can be more human. But also she sometimes imagines herself laying in bed naked with this creepy Vulcan.
Yeah.
Probably having sex. But again, it's cable, basic cable. So, but she awakes with a fright. And this is where I was like, this is a pretty cookie cutter episode so far. I mean, it's not terrible. It's just kind of bland because it's just like, okay, I see exactly where this is going.
Yeah.
She heads to Phlox. She's agitated. It's also kind of like, even for a Phlox scene, pretty boring and straightforward. She's just like, I know what's wrong. I didn't meditate.
Yeah.
Give me the drugs for when a Vulcan doesn't meditate, I guess.
Yeah. Also, you know what? I think this Phlox scene is no good because who is the name of the fail son? Like Ka.
Yeah, or something. Vowel or something.
Whatever. He's stealing the Phlox heat this episode. He's acting very Phloxy.
Yeah.
He's a Phloxy character. That's why I like him, maybe. They only know how to write one guy that's cool, and it's Phlox.
Yeah.
And they're just like, well, here's a different kind of chubby guy, and he's just like kind of frank about his sexuality. and he thinks everybody is his friend. And that's Phlox also.
That's true. That's a good point.
Huh?
Speaking of, I missed the names, and I didn't know who they were talking about, and so when Archer basically invites the fail son in, and it turns out to be this kid, I'm like, oh, I love him even more. He hates his dad because his dad said, you brought 15 generations of shame on our family, or shame to our 15 generations or something. And he's like, we said goodbye a long time ago. You can tell him that. Like,
that was good. That was an affecting line.
I wrote that one down because it's like, damn, I can see why you don't give a shit and you're living on a commune and you enjoy sex. I mentioned that they're trying to figure out how to reduce the 7-year cycle so they can bang more.
That's right.
So we get back to the Talaris story where he's getting like extra creepy now. Like, this is where I think his acting isn't half bad because he is definitely presenting this guy as a creep now, and pretty effectively, because he's all like, what did you dream about? What was, tell me, it'll help me understand things and free your mind, kind of thing. She tells him, after like a lot of pressure, she starts recounting it, but only the like the jazz part. She does not talk about getting horny.
No,
fair
why
enough.
Would she?
But she did say that she felt invigorated about the music. And he's like, that's emotion. You felt emotion. And she's suddenly like shameful about it. Because that is what cultural society, the Vulcan society at this time, enforces.
Right.
But we're learning something. The Vulcans might be changing. It's just not, this guy's not helping.
No.
Archer at this point asks Trip for help because he struck out with our fail son. And he realizes that, Trip, you've been working with him a lot. You seem like your buddy. Also, by the way, have you noticed how much T'Pol is hanging out with that Talaris guy? Boy, is that really making me chuffed. And Trip's like, dude, she hasn't seen her people in months. Just let her live. Yeah,
wouldn't you be hanging out if you hadn't seen a human in fucking a year?
And this is one of those times where it starts to make me think like, okay, you know what? There's something here to the fact that like Archer goes way too hard trying to be like, T'Pol, let's get in a relationship. Well, Trip is actually like, hey, respect her, dude. I'm curious how one would have sex with a Vulcan.
Yeah, very carefully. Archer is racist, though, against Vulcans.
It's true. I think. We've established this multiple times, even in this episode.
Yeah.
But it's also time, once again, to get to the deep lore, because we're doing a mind meld.
Ooh.
Maddie,
you know, this is a real
this
is a real lore-heavy episode.
It is.
And I wish we were talking about Data's brother, but we're not.
Mm-mm.
We're not.
God, oh, if only.
If only lore showed up.
this mind meld was a lot more breathy than I remember mind melds being.
It's really sensual.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense, right? Like, this is like the proto, like, we have just figured out, like, this is an ancient Vulcan technique.
Yes.
That we've reclaimed. So it makes sense that they're doing it more emotionally because they are the emotion boys.
Uh-huh.
Weird, there's no women on the ship, FYI.
Hmm.
It's cool that, like, there's just no women in space at this juncture. Anyways.
They use the mind meld at first. It's just like, relive your dream.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, eventually, it's like, at first it's the regular way, the mind meld, they put their hands on each other's faces, they start just talking. But then eventually it goes to this, like, she's reliving her dream, we're seeing the scenes again.
Yeah, she's back in the horny zone.
Yeah, and we're getting back.
Which is to say trumpets.
Cut back to him talking to her, and she's just like staring off into space blankly. But as she's reliving it, it starts to get weird. She's not liking it, and she specifically says, stop. And he is like getting angry, and he's like, no, let me keep going. And it's extremely obvious what's going on here. This is absolutely a sexual assault, like, metaphor. Especially after, like, she kind of just shoves him off of her and is like, he just says, you're feeling anger. It's your fault you reacted this way. I mean, it's gross. It's meant to be.
Yes.
And I don't really have problems with how this went, but it's what happens later that is kind of like the major fail of this episode. But
yeah,
we'll get to that. She collapses after like shouting him to leave, but manages to call sick bay. So
yeah,
that's kind of how that resolves.
Not great.
It's not great, but
it's not great.
I get what they're going for.
Yeah, it's like sort of like we're like pantomiming a sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit.
And we just move on to our angry fail son, who Trip is trying to convince to talk to his daddy. He doesn't want to, but eventually we get Trip talking about a girl that he wanted to dance with in like middle school or something.
Uh-huh.
And never had the courage to ask. I'm just like, why are you telling him this?
I like how he also very casually just mentions Panama City, Florida, like this guy is gonna know what that is,
right? Oh yeah, I forgot he's a Florida guy.
Oh, it's very important that he's a Florida guy.
It's
very important, put that in your mind, listener.
Yes. Florida man trip
Tucker. But like, so it's so funny because he's like, hey man, let me tell you about, you're new to emotions, and I've been having emotions my whole life.
Exactly.
So let me tell you about one of the big ones. It's called regret.
Yes.
I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a really stupid speech.
So we get there. Yeah. He's telling this because you might regret this. I regretted this thing, and I've thought about it for 20 years. So, you know, don't miss your chance. And okay.
I could have married this woman who definitely won't be killed in some sort of Florida 9/11.
So we go back to Archer, and he calls in Talaris. And he's kind of plays dumb at the beginning of this. He's just like, hey, by the way, Talaris, you're not going to be working with T'Pol. She's in sick bay. And eventually he's just like, yeah, by the way, why is she in sick bay? And he's like, oh, it's a personal problem or something. Archer is, yeah, again, playing this kind of dumb at first, and then just suddenly is just like, hey, jerk, what did you do to her?
Yeah.
And Talaris is like, she needs guidance. She's in a very delicate moment of her, like, opening her mind to her emotions and stuff. And he's just continuing his very creepy perspective to this idea of bringing your emotions under control. And Archer, like, very intentionally, like, gets in his way and he's provoking him. Like, that's Archer's plan here. And as we know from the lore, Vulcans are very strong. So he, like, throws Archer into the ceiling and then throws him across the room. Archer kind of meant for that to happen because he's got a gun. He just pulls a phaser on him. He's like, did you mean to do this intentionally? And Archer's like, oh, I didn't mean to get thrown across the room, but yeah. And I was like, okay, so they're going to tell the Vulcan High Command that this guy's a piece of shit, or at least his captain? No. He just lets the mind rapist get away, and it's like...
Yeah, and everybody else that's leaving is still, like, friendly about it.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre.
We don't even know if any of them were told. It's just like, I guess this is 2002, and it's just kind of like, hey, cut that shit out. It's like the best we can get.
Hey, get out of my episode immediately.
Yeah.
And never come back.
Never come back. So that's like the main disappointment. It's like, if you're going to make this point, like, treat it with the seriousness it deserves. And that's the kind of thing that, like, really got me on this. But anyway, the fail son storyline has a nice ending, which is that he does call his dad. He tells Trip this. Trip makes a friend.
And he's like, hey, good news. He no longer has Vulcan cancer.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, okay, I guess that all happened off screen. Okay, goodbye.
Great.
Bye.
And to end on it, we get an archer checking in on T'Pol, meditating. This was good, I thought. The way Archer acts in this seems appropriate. The seriousness he conveys is as much as he didn't do shit about it, really. Besides get the guy off the ship, the way he checks on her, and then as he's leaving, she's just like, "Hey, can I ask a question? Do you dream?"
Yeah.
And he's like, "Yeah, sure, most nights." And it's like, "Is it enjoyable?" And he's like, "Most of the time." And her quick, like, "I envy you."
Yeah.
And then catches herself, like, that she responded like that quickly, kind of emotionally. Envy's an emotion. But then it's just like, "Good night." And I was like, "Oh, that was good. That actually was probably the best, like, way to convey how she's feeling in this scene, in this episode, you know, in the best reading of it, of her, like, I wish I could be human and also it didn't suck." Because she's like, there's things he wants about it, but, like, clearly humans also have nightmares. Like, not every dream is good. Like, that's unfortunately the point that I think sometimes they make about this bridging the human Vulcan divide with emotions, is that, like, emotions are good and sometimes they're bad, and that's the thing you have to learn to live with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we could all learn a little lesson about that.
Shouldn't have to live with mental assault.
Yeah, I don't think mind assault is good. I'm against it.
But so that was T'Pol's first big episode, and
yeah,
leaves something to be desired, but she still handles it in far as acting. I still really like what she does. So
I think her performances are really good generally. I think this episode was at least interesting. It held my attention, which so many episodes lately we're not doing. So yeah. I'll tell you that much. I did not have to watch it at 2x speed to get through it, which I can only say, I can't say for, say, the episode Shuttle Pod 1.
And unfortunately also remembered what this episode eventually is foreshadowing, which is another kind of problematic plot, but we'll get to that one.
I actually don't remember what you're talking about.
Oh, boy. Get ready. It's in season 2, so you got time to remember
metaphor. I'm glad. Great. Wonderful. Oh! Oh!
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right.
Which just really adds a lot to the whole hippie commune thing going on here.
It's sure does. Well, Clayton.
Until next time.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for letting us consensually mind meld with you, our listening audience. We've got a Patreon. It's $1 a month. If you want to hear, we got like an extra episode a month where we do a movie or something.
Yeah, I think we've kind of decided that the most thing we're most excited to do is that first movie we like discovered on the first episode we ever did.
Oh yeah,
Musketeer or The Musketeer.
It's just The Musketeer.
The most, that movie came out kind of movie that
we've seen yet.
So look we'll for that.
We'll have to do 2001 to 2004 movie club. look out for that. Anything else you want to plug?
I guess it's probably news out there that I am no longer employed where I'm usually employed at Vox Media's Polygon. Sad story, but I'll just say this. There is potentially still a GoFundMe up for me and my colleagues that if you feel inclined to donate to, it helps us all out as we figure out what to do next. Like me. I don't know what I'm doing next, but you can look out for that.
Well, you're watching The Musketeer, I guess, on
Patreon.
That's
what I'm doing next, literally. But
I'll get that in the show notes if it's still up. And if it's not up, I'll link to somewhere else helpful. well, until next time.
Yeah, for Temporal Culture War, I'm Clayton Ashley.
And I'm Maddie Lipchansky. And, of course, as always,
let's go.